Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor DeWine last week signed a bill prohibiting public K-12 schools and colleges from mandating that students or staff get COVID-19 vaccines. This comes as the coronavirus cases and hospitalizations once again are trending up. Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Chief Medical Officer for the Ohio Department of Health, described the problem.
So the reality is we now have two Ohios. An Ohio that is vaccinated and protected on the one hand, and an Ohio that is unvaccinated and vulnerable to Delta on the other.
The governor says he's hoping the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will give the vaccines full approval before the new law takes effect, because that's the condition for allowing schools and colleges to mandate the vaccine, that it has that approval.
I've expressed this to the White House, and I'm publicly today again expressing it to the FDA. It's time. It really is time for you to give full approval. We have lives at stake, and we cannot wait any longer.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
And in his maiden journey on the show, Andrew Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome aboard.
Ahoy.
Governor DeWine has staked the state and his political future on getting people vaccinated. Why sign that bill banning mandates for schools that want to impose them? What, Julie Carr-Smythe, I mean, what's the equation there?
Well, you know, he's under the gun because he's up for re-election in a party that is largely pushing the responsible for the pushback on these vaccines, and he has to walk this line. He got them to take it out of the budget and put it in a separate bill, and it does have this provision, right, that says that it only bans it if it's a vaccine used on an emergency basis. So it's not banning, for example, measles, mumps, rubella, or something like that. And if the FDA approves it, then the whole bill is moot. So I think he's trying to walk that political line.
So it's politics, Andrew, plain and simple.
Yeah, it was funny, actually. I saw on Facebook the sponsor of this measure in the Senate, Andrew Brenner, when Governor DeWine signed it, said, like, he signed it. It was kind of like he couldn't believe that it happened. And it is interesting. You know, the governor has suggested that because there's 90 days before it takes the time that must pass for a law to take effect, that that's well after the school year has begun. So it's a little bit of wily political gamesmanship from the governor, where he can say, I signed the bill, but by the time that it actually takes effect, it's really not going to have any practical purpose. So I don't think the governor was enthusiastic about possibly having another veto override vote queued up. It's been an issue that, like, as Julie said, with the primary coming up, every time it happens, it probably makes him a little reminds voters in the Republican primary kind of for that sort of thing. But yeah, so I do think that the governor was likely being strategic in the way that he approached this.
Mm. Well, and the bill also, it wasn't solely on this issue. That this piece of it was put into an existing bill that would expand education opportunities for military families, for children, allowing them to enroll online or in advance as they're going to, you know, move to a new deployment. So, you know, there are other things in the bill that the governor liked. And I think, you know, he just kind of did the math, so to speak, and felt confident that it wouldn't actually have that great of effect. And practically speaking, it only applies to public universities and schools. And I don't know of a school district that had decided already to mandate vaccines. I know Cincinnati Public Schools was considering a mandate for their staff, but not for students. I haven't heard of anybody doing a student mandate at this time. But Cleveland State University had required students who were going to be living in dorms to be vaccinated.
And as you said, Julie, I mean, they could still do that.
Right.
Before the law goes into effect, if they want to be stinkers about it, right?
Well, I mean, he was asked about it. The governor was asked about it last week, specifically that question. And he said, you know, they can, of course they can do that. And, you know, I trust that they're going to do what they need to do to protect their communities.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau Chief. Also with us, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Andrew Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. The latest increase in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations comes off of the 4th of July holiday a couple weeks ago. Just the same old thing. You know, there's an uptick now. Do we have a sense yet? Are they talking about it? About whether this is a blip or going to be a longer-term trend. Andrew?
So some of the other states, especially in the Deep South, have had some really troubling trends in terms of the case numbers and stuff like that. And I know we've been looking out, you know, the numbers of cases in Ohio that are reported are still in the hundreds, whereas, you know, we were very accustomed to them being in the thousands before. So I don't think we're there yet. But obviously, the things that are happening in other states, it's not like Ohio has this, you know, like a hermetically sealed bubble around it or anything like that. So the health officials last week said they are concerned about the spread of the Delta variant, which is believed to be more contagious. And so it's definitely something that's on their radar.
Right. And it's hard. I mean, we have to be reminded that even if you're vaccinated, you can still get the virus. It's just at a lesser level, which means you can still transmit it. Right, Jackie?
Right. And there have been some, I think, kind of high profile news events lately, like those Democratic lawmakers from Texas that fled the state and went to D.C. And now a couple of them have tested positive and they were vaccinated. And I think, you know, all along that message has been there that, you know, the vaccines are not 100% effective and, you know, they will keep you out of the hospital or they will prevent you from dying. And I think people thought, when they saw, you know, the high numbers of how effective they were, that meant that they wouldn't get it. But
right.
No, I mean, breakthrough cases were always something that was going to happen. And I think what we're hearing from the hospitals is that the people who are coming to them in hospital or dying and having this severe COVID are people who were not vaccinated.
And that goes back to what Dr. Vanderhoff said in that first segment where, you know, we have two Ohios now in terms of the really severe cases. It's those who aren't vaccinated who are really at the highest risk. And, you know, that's it's unfortunate when people are vaccinated and still get it, but they're not necessarily dying of it.
The Vax-a-Million got a lot of attention internationally, nationally. Late night TV enjoyed it, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't do much good, right, Andrew?
Yeah, the numbers were really kind of mixed on it. And when it came in, it would kind of coincided with a pretty broad expansion of eligibility of the vaccine, which kind of muddied the data a little bit. So it's one of those things that sounded interesting. It got a lot of attention. A lot of other states emulated it in the aftermath. But there was a study, and I can't recall the university that performed it, but basically found that the effect that it had was negligible. But, you know, the real Vax-a-Million are the friends we made along the way. So, you know.
Right. So what's next? The governor has promised new incentives, but we haven't heard anything yet?
Yeah, he's been hinting at another round of incentives for about a month now. You know, he was asked, I think, on Friday again about it and said he wasn't ready to yet talk about it. But, you know, when he's been hinting, it's not going to be another Vax-a-Million. You know, he's talked about that maybe smaller prizes and more of those smaller prizes might be a better incentive. And this is something that when the Vax-a-Million was rolled out, we talked to some experts in, you know, marketing and behavioral health behavioral, you know, patterns related to psychology and incentives and you know, they were mixed on it. In some instances, like a big pot of money or one really big prize can incentivize people. But on the other hand, having smaller prizes, you know, it was kind of well, we'll wait and see. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, more frequent prizes or smaller prizes are targeted towards certain populations.
Kind of like the $2 scratch off card kind of a thing. That generates a lot more money than people would realize for the Ohio Lottery.
Right.
And than the big ones.
And I think, too, that those there's a psychology that maybe those are a little more likely to win.
More accessible, yeah.
And we're also seeing some interesting Republicans in other states that are worse off even than Ohio are, you know, they're trying something different. They're saying, okay, fine, don't trust the government and don't trust, you know, the CDC. If you won't trust your own doctor, at least go and ask. And they're trying really hard to get people to get vaccinated while, as we're talking about, walking this line of people who are reticent and they don't know what's going on. And going back to DeWine urging the FDA to approve this, I mean, that would be a piece of it because people still feel...
Well, it's experimental, period,
And that we're all the guinea pigs, right? And so for those who are concerned about that, the message is don't trust the government. Don't trust Dr. Fauci. Just trust your own doctor. Why don't you at least go ask?
I was driving through Michigan this week, and they're doing things like season tickets to Tigers games, I think, or something. Now, don't quote me on that. It was season tickets to some big athletic team. It could have been Michigan or Michigan State, for all I know. But and then smaller, like gift cards and things like that. It was, and which means if it's the smaller the prize, the more people will get that prize.
Right. Well, but we've also seen some pushback by the anti-vaccine movement on that, that's a bribery of some kind. I know that happened at Ohio State, right, that they were offering kids
incentives.
An incentive.
I guess incentive bribery, conflating.
Okay. You really can't win.
You can't win. Los Angeles County has reinstated its indoor mask mandate for everyone now. You know, that's usually a leading indicator when you're talking about something on the West Coast or East Coast. DeWine last week was asked about whether Ohio would follow suit. What's your sense about that, Jackie Borchardt?
Not at this time. I don't think that's on. And I think that what he had said last week was he doesn't plan to, period. I don't know if we get into a scenario where things are getting really bad again. The issue is we have now a law on the books that allows the legislature to step in and remove, you know, some of these health orders, various health orders that the governor and the health department director have issued over throughout the pandemic. And it also limits local departments' ability to enact broad public health measures like a mask mandate or closing of, you know, a whole sector of business or schools and such. So, you know, we're kind of in a position where the tools are a little bit more limited than they were last year. But, you know, the biggest tool, the best tool that we have is the vaccine. And so that's kind of the position the governor has taken now is when we need to ramp up the vaccine effort. I think that we'll start to see probably, I mean, this, it all also depends on what the CDC says. Mm-hmm. You know, the CDC in the spring, when they said, hey, if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask. I think a lot of people saw that as, okay, we're done. I'm vaccinated and I don't need to worry about this going forward. And of course, we're seeing, you know, that the international guidance from the World Health Organization, which is more geared toward places with lower vaccination rates than the U.S., but still, I think applies here in that if you are in an area where there are, you know, low vaccination rates and high spread, then, yeah, masking makes a lot of sense. And it's honestly, it's a very low, you know, low impact. It doesn't really affect, you know, it's not, I don't know. I personally don't have a big issue with wearing a mask in a place.
Yeah,
it's a thing I put on my face
it.
And, you know, I take it off when I get out of the store, you know, wherever. So as far as interventions go, like that is probably the least intrusive. You know, it's not closing things down. So mm-hmm. I could see, you know, maybe not a mandate, but just, you know, encouraging people or issuing guidance or advice. And of course, if the CDC comes back and says, okay, well, now we're kind of changing our guidance going forward, that might make a difference.
You know, another thing, he has ended his, the governor has ended his once or twice a week 2 o'clock wine with DeWine, as people joked about it back in the day. But I'm wondering, did anyone ask him or has anyone asked him about if there's another surge, if there's another crisis from all of this, such as it is, would he resume that? Do you have a sense about that, Andrew?
I don't know that he would specifically want to bring that back. And I think, too, that earlier on in the pandemic, I feel that he had a really big mouthpiece because I think people were scared and there were a lot of unknowns at that point in time.
He had Amy Acton, too.
Right. And just the goodwill that he had at that moment, I don't think he's ever going to really get that back. Even if things get really bad, I think that people will perceive them through polarized lenses. And also, it's very difficult to imagine things getting that bad again because of the level of vaccinations that do exist in the country. So, So I don't really know what the purpose would be for him to resume the show, other than that, again, if for some reason he feels that that's a way for him to get through to people in a way that he wouldn't otherwise. But like I said, it's just I don't see it sitting here personally.
And it makes him a sitting duck for the pot shots from the people who don't like him.
Right, right. I mean, you know, when he went out before, as Andrew says, there was a high public need for that information and for to tamper down any misinformation that was happening. And everybody was starting from scratch trying to understand what was happening. And so it was really he was one of the most aggressive and first to do that. But now, you know, we're not the worst in the country by far in terms of vaccination rates. And
28th, I think we rank.
Right. So that's what we like to be, right? 28th.
We like to be 28th. Between 25 and 33, I always say. 25 and 33. We're going to take a quick break. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Julie Carr Smythe of the, she's a State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Also with us, Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, and Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Student vaccinations were the talk of the most recent meeting of the Ohio State Board of Education, and board member Diana Fessler raised objections and eyebrows when she asked Superintendent Paolo Di Maria this question.
Now, I'm just wondering what kind of influence Bill Gates does have on you, because Education First Consulting, there seems to be one person in every single state, and you seem to be our guy. How are you paid by Bill Gates?
Okay, right about there, somebody interrupted her and said, whoa, but it is our weekly reporter roundtable still with us, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, Associated Press State House correspondent Julie Carr Smythe, and Cleveland.com State House reporter Andrew Tobias. Jackie Borchardt, what's her problem?
Well, you know, since the pandemic began, there's been a conspiracy theory that Bill Gates is, you know, been involved in the vaccine development, that he's, you know, that the vaccine will have a microchip developed by Bill Gates that can track everybody. I mean, Bill Gates has become a COVID boogeyman in the way that George Soros has become a boogeyman for everything on the left. And, you know, what her question pertains to was, and I guess it was, you know, a previous position that he had held, working with an organization that was Gates funded. And, you know, the Gates Foundation has funded all sorts of philanthropic efforts. So, you know, where this question sounds, you know, comes out of kind of left field there. But it's, you know, it's in line with a school of thought in the during the COVID pandemic, that Bill Gates has this force in you know, boosting the virus and using it for his gain.
But just to be clear, Paolo Di Maria is paid by the state. He is not paid by Bill Gates,
yes,
right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and how did he respond to all of that?
I mean, he recently retired, so I wouldn't think that's directly related or anything like that. But it's just, I mean, I've not completely understood this whole line of thinking, just because if you look at the officials in Ohio and how they're reacting, it's really no different than any other state, you know, more or less, and, you know, at the federal level. So I just don't really know what to make of this kind of thing, to be honest.
I just it's part of a line of thinking on the right now that's sort of anti-big tech, I think, because, you know, Bill Gates, obviously Microsoft, but his foundation has funded a lot of work in education. Mark Zuckerberg was part of a foundation this past—
And vaccines, but yeah.
Who is the CEO of Facebook, had funded a foundation that was helping local election boards cope with the COVID vaccine by giving them money, for example, for PPE and other accommodations. And the lawmakers in the Republican-led legislature have banned that kind of thing in reaction. We've obviously have a lot of people still upset that Twitter banned Donald Trump. And, you know, so it is sort of in line with the rightward thinking that big tech is just under their influencing everything all the time.
All right. So another issue before the state school board, it has asked the Attorney General of Ohio to decide whether a resolution to, quote, condemn racism and to advance equity and opportunity, end quote, for minority students went beyond the board's legal authority. Do you guys know what's going on there?
I mean, I think that you ask for an opinion from the Attorney General if you don't want to actually do something on something that's controversial,
but
you want to act
it.
Like you're doing it. Yeah. So they passed that resolution last summer. It was kind of in the aftermath of the George Floyd protests and before the issue of that particular issue had gotten heavily politicized. So it went through. And as people have become more concerned in recent months on the right about critical race theory and things like that, people came to view that resolution through that lens. And so it's just there's been this parade of testimony about it and concerns that have been raised. And so the state school board actually restricted testimony on that issue and invited a First Amendment lawsuit out of Cincinnati. I mean, it's just been this whole thing that hasn't gotten a ton of broad attention or anything like that, but it's been going on for a while. And so, like I said, it's this controversial issue that they've been dealing with. And so what better way to seem like you're doing something than to ask for a legal opinion about it from the Attorney General and kind of pass the buck.
Right. And Jim Renacci, who is DeWine's Republican challenger.
One of them, yeah.
One of them has alleged in some ads that DeWine's school board is behind critical race theory, which is inaccurate. But, you know, Renacci's campaign is trying to make an issue of that and tie DeWine to that. So in that sense, it's political.
Also on the issue of education, the state budget, which was approved on time, includes the language of the Fair School Funding Plan that would spend nearly $11 billion on education over the next 2 years. Is there a way to do a thumbnail for listeners on what's fair about it?
Well, being extremely general, because if you've ever listened to any conversation from the experts on Ohio school funding, it is very complicated. But what this aims to do to be more fair is to incorporate kind of a better idea of the wealth of the district and what they can contribute to education and just state funding appropriately. So kind of recognizing that, you know, not all school districts, you know, we rely a lot on property taxes to fund school districts. And that's generally been found to be unconstitutional in most states, including Ohio. And so this tries to balance that out with, you know, allocating the state funding and more state funding. It also, one thing that I think everybody was pleased to see is it changes the way that charter schools are funded, mm-hmm. where before the money would go to the school district and then kind of get subtracted per student and sent to the charter school. So this now the state is directly funding charter schools, so it doesn't even go into the school district.
But I understand that voucher opponents oppose that.
That's charter schools. It's different.
Okay, gotcha.
So now then the third, I think, big issue is it does expand vouchers. It raises the rate that they're paid back. And I don't have the numbers in front of me. I would screw them up. But I know for high school, it increases it, I think, by at least $1,000. So, you know, vouchers, if I were to, I'm picturing a chart that I have seen many times, but if you look at the last 10 years of vouchers in Ohio, they have just grown exponentially. And so the voucher language that was put in was not really part of the Fair School Funding Plan. It was that Senate President Matt Huffman and other supporters in the Senate had put that language in. So it became part of the compromise to get education through because the Senate was not a big fan of school funding plan. So we have both of those things now. And looking ahead, I'm sure we're going to see a lawsuit, at least one from a group that has a coalition of school districts. I think they're up to more than 75 now that are planning a lawsuit on the grounds that the state is increasing funding to vouchers while neglecting their responsibility to fully fund public schools.
Which is kind of what their job is.
Yeah.
It is their mandate, yes.
Yeah. Okay, and so the voucher opponents, what they're preparing to file a lawsuit about is the plan to increase the value of private school vouchers.
Well, they've been preparing for a lawsuit for months now. I think last year is when they kind of started getting the ball rolling on just how vouchers have become such a big piece of state funding for public education. But this most recent expansion in the budget, the supporters of this effort think really adds to their case.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief. Also with us, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, and Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Let's see, wind and solar. Governor DeWine last week signed a bill that would create an additional hurdle for wind and solar companies hoping to do business in Ohio, a hurdle that nuclear, fracking interests, oil and gas, any of that don't have to meet. What's going on, Andrew?
So first off, I wanted to say I was not necessarily surprised that the governor signed it, but you could see where there could be a local control issue that might come up that the governor has been sympathetic to those kinds of arguments. But the what the bill would do is allow for local communities and local county commissioners specifically to block solar and wind projects. And also, by the way, there's lobbying on this from the Chamber of Commerce and business groups, because right now there is a major push to expand what's called industrial size or industrial scale solar, where you have big data companies want to have they have kind of corporate goals on in terms of sustainability and the
right.
sourcing for their electricity and stuff like that. So there's this big push to expand in places like Ohio, where there's relatively a lot of land and that kind of thing. But communities, or rather like residents, don't like having big wind turbines especially built, just because of you can see them obviously for miles.
Well, yeah, but people don't like fracking either.
Right.
But
yeah, and so for me, I mean, like, I did some reporting a couple of years ago that it didn't really end up in a story, but I spoke with a woman where there was a large natural gas plant that was built, like, literally in her backyard.
Yeah.
And you can imagine she really didn't like that.
Yeah.
But in that
case,
she
didn't have any control over
that. The Power
that.
Siting Board, which is a state regulatory agency, it's very obscure, approved that, and it's a $1 billion project. There's economic arguments made for it and stuff like that. So in this case, there was Bill Reinecke is a state legislator who was a big proponent. There was a project in Seneca County that he represents that had been local residents have been trying to fight for a while. So that's what the base of that legislation was. And as you're saying, it is different than natural gas, fossil fuels, kind of traditional power companies, the projects that raise similar issues in the communities, but they don't have the same kinds of rules now. So.
Right. And I'm just wondering if there's any sense that there's a opposition to that in the courts.
You could see somebody saying that you're treating us differently than another similarly situated project. But in this case, I mean, I think it all has to do with kind of the politics of who wants what, you know, like oil and gas industry versus renewables. I think there's just kind of traditional sources of support for those kinds of projects.
Yeah, and traditional kinds of support for politicians come from those companies.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're embedded. And so, I mean, we've seen in this state that the renewables industry has just had a lot of difficulty getting a foothold, even though, I mean, they've been an incredible job creator. We've seen reports come out showing, you know, the interest in it on the business side. But there's been a real pushback to it. And we have a lot of worry that it would hurt the traditional sources. You know, we even saw that with fracking. They were trying to lobby against that.
And yeah, and I think, you know, to Julie's point, some in the business industry or business community in the state oppose this bill, because a lot of, you know, businesses that Ohio is trying to attract from the West Coast or the East Coast or elsewhere, like Amazon, have invested heavily in renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And that's part of something that they look for when they're looking for a new site, is if they're going to be able to have enough renewable energy to support their new operations?
You know, there's the other issue. I mean, there's lots of other issues that are getting a lot of public and national attention that are coming out of Ohio. The Conscience Clause, giving healthcare providers the option to not serve somebody if what the service is conflicts with their personal views or their religious views and that kind of a thing. And I know Tom Suttis, you know, in his column on Sunday in the Dispatch, made that point that this stuff's going out there. This is what people, you can spend $50,000 or $50 million a year doing billboards saying move to Ohio, and that's all good, well and good, but this kind of stuff is what's flying around, you know, on late night TV.
Right. And I mean, that's what's interesting is that the Republican Party that dominates all three branches of government in Ohio, you know, they are saying they often they're free marketeers, but then they're limiting selectively certain industries for certain reasons. And, you know, they're imposing certain social values on things. So, I mean, I just find that interesting that in the energy field that they wouldn't let the renewable industry
compete,
do as well as it could.
Equal footing, yeah.
And, you know, but we had these mandates on requiring a certain amount of renewable energy, and those were... They got rid of those. And so,
in House Bill 6, by the way.
Right.
Which looms over
right,
everything.
Which is, you know, from the standpoint of the renewables companies, that's a way to assert some predictability in the market because you're able to say, oh, we have these, we're going to have a guaranteed market that can get us started, and then we can see what's happening. Now, you know, we're not the biggest solar state in the country, obviously, but. You know, many companies, even in AEP solar field, I think was a huge project there, had a lot of hurdles put in its way. And, you know, for whatever reasons.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Andrew Tobias, Associated Press Statehouse correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe, and USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. All right, so two Democratic state representatives have drafted a bill to legalize recreational marijuana cultivation and sales. Yeah, they're Democrats. So in a state, as you mentioned a little earlier, Julie, is, you know, completely controlled by Republicans, but does this have a snowflake's chance?
No, not okay. This bill. I would say not this bill and the way it's written.
Okay.
But I think it's notable in that it's the first legislative attempt that we have in Ohio to legalize marijuana for personal use.
Well, since the buddy guy.
Well, that was a ballot issue, right?
Yes.
So, you know, and on this issue, this especially is an issue that the legislature has been very hesitant to deal with forever. Mm-hmm. And they only dealt with it back in 2016 because we had the 2015 legalization measure, Responsible Ohio Issue 3, which failed. But then we had another very well-funded, out-of-state sponsored medical-only amendment for the Constitution, and the lawmakers did not like that. They didn't want anything in the Constitution, and so they moved extremely quickly, like breakneck speed as far as the legislature goes.
Because they can
and got
when
it,
they want to.
Yeah, and they got it done in a couple months. And, of course, that brings us to today. And, you know, we now are in a very different, as a country, in a different position than we were 5 years ago. We're now up to 18 states that have legalized marijuana for
state,
broader use,
including
Michigan.
Yeah.
And that is a huge factor in this. So this bill, the sponsors modeled it mostly after Michigan with little dashes of some other things that are happening in other states. But yeah, having Michigan, Pennsylvania is moving in that direction as well. Mm-hmm. Illinois is also
they're
a recreational
direct,
state.
I cannot believe how many billboards. You know, again, I was up in Michigan over the weekend. I mean, it's just billboard after billboard after billboard.
Either that or sports betting, which we also
we don't have yet in
with
Ohio.
With dispensary, you know. I mean, and, you know, all I see that as is the dispensaries are really trying to compete with each other, and they're trying to stand out and all that kind of junk. But one of them was one saying, Ohio, can we just have a truce? And it was about some, you know, witticism about, you know, come here for your, you know, dispensary needs. I mean, that's what finally tripped Ohio into casino gambling was the competition for other states. But by then it was all lost.
Right. And that's kind of the point that Representative Casey Weinstein, he's a Hudson Democrat. That's what he's one of the sponsors of the bill. Mm-hmm. And that's the point he was trying to make last week is, as a legislature, we need to start talking about this issue now. We're already behind by that. We haven't really had a serious discussion about it, because if we don't, there will be an effort that comes in from, you know, usually probably the industry
out of state
advocacy group that comes in and, you know, is going to put something through that the legislature may not like. And the thing they don't like the most is not having their hands in it. Right. So, I mean, that's his main point is we need to have the discussion in Ohio and how we want it to look like in Ohio, because we don't want to be last. And we already have people in Ohio who are going to Michigan and coming back. They're also driving through Illinois and New York now is also, you know, not that far from us. So
I like the signs that say easy on, easy off, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, by the way, that Casey Weinstein is the one who sponsored this. And I also it's surprising to me that Democrats haven't yet brought a legalization bill. But so in that case, you know, we definitely can take a view of whether it's likely to pass. It's not likely to pass.
Right.
But he represents a competitive district in kind of suburban Cleveland area. He could potentially be defeated for re-election. He sees it being as something that he's unafraid to attach his name to. So if we just kind of like read into what the larger politics are at play, I thought that was interesting.
I guess maybe he's seeing some numbers somewhere that say most people would approve it. It wouldn't count against them.
Well, that was even the case, like Jackie says, back in 2016. And that polling was a huge driving force. And what wound up happening was lawmakers said, you know, if you don't go to the ballot, you know, we will pass something. And they did, but they passed medical. And, you know, recreational has always been a bridge too far, at least here. But you make a perfect point that with casinos, it was all the gambling was all around. Why not us?
Well, I think if we hadn't had the pandemic last year, I think we would have seen an issue last year.
On the ballot?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there were a lot of ballot issues that were brewing.
Right.
A huge number of them.
I'm wondering 2022 if that's a ripe time for.
Well, going back to the politics of it, a marijuana legalization issue on the ballot in 2022 is like not what the Republicans want at all, because it is one of those issues that crosses party lines. It has support from Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that anything that would, you know, maybe bring more people out or bring out, you know, maybe more liberal
light
voters.
Light up the bases. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily light up
anything
the opposition.
Anything that would bring out more voters would be bad for the Republicans.
Well, no, I mean, it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like in 2004 with the DOMA, with the same-sex marriage law, which, you know, many credited with helping boost Republican turnout in that year. And this issue doesn't necessarily do that, but it definitely would be an issue that you don't want on the ballot in a year where you're Republicans don't want it on the ballot,
yeah.
I should say.
Yeah, like Governor Mike DeWine is not going to come out in favor of legalizing marijuana. So that would definitely put him in a spot for sure.
Yeah, because if it's on the ballot, then it's going to be something natural to ask any candidate that's on the ballot as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So speaking of candidates on the ballot, there's another possible Republican candidate for U.S. Senate to replace outgoing retiring Rob Portman, Republican. State Senator Matt Dolan of suburban Cleveland. I mean, what I know about him is his family owns what? Is it the Indians?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, so what about him? What do we know, Andrew?
Yeah, he's been kind of, you know, when Rob Portman announced that he wasn't running for re-election, seemingly every Republican in Ohio kind of said that they were considering running, and Matt Dolan was one of them. One of the things that you kind of heard out of his people was that he was waiting for the state budget to pass. He played a very central role in negotiating that. He's the Senate Finance Committee chairman, and just he really is at the table in negotiating those kinds of things. So now that that's passed, and now that we've entered sort of the summer period for campaign finance reporting, he has said that he is forming an exploratory committee to consider running. And, you know, so personally, I don't think he has a great chance of winning. He sees his, I think, his opportunity to differentiate himself from the other candidates in the field who've really made who is the most true Trump supporter is kind of like the overriding issue at this phase of the race, trying to kind of get their names out there with activists in the Republican Party. But what Matt Dolan would say is that, you know, I'm the only one who's running who actually holds elected office, which, you know, is kind of weird if you think about it. You have multiple first time candidates who are kind of considered leading candidates in the field. And also, he says that he thinks that the campaign needs to talk more about Ohio. So he's not committing to actually running. I would really be surprised if his name appeared on the ballot next year. But that's what he's doing right now.
Right. And I think that there's a way in which, you know, I asked him, would he rather have Rob Portman's endorsement or Donald Trump's endorsement? And of course, he would like both. But, you know, there's a sense that everybody is tacking extremely right to try to get Trump's attention. And he doesn't seem to really be doing that. His rhetoric was more around, you know.
Yeah, Dolan tweeted after amidst the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol that I don't have it in front of me, but he said leadership has failed. That starts with Donald Trump. Like, we can't lie about, I think he said lie about the election, but he's talking about lying and leadership and stuff like that. So he really did stake out a pretty, you know, that's become in the Republican Party an aggressive stance, I guess, to say those kinds of things. So that's just probably not going to win the Republican primary right now, based on what we're seeing.
But not to be, he's certainly a conservative Republican.
Yes. One thing he pointed out was that, for example, he voted no on the heartbeat bill, which is, you know, it's been shot down as unconstitutional in multiple places and is now pending from another state in the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, he's like, I'm voting conservative, but I'm voting also pragmatically, and I'm going to aggressively fight for Ohio issues. And, you know, to Andrew's point, the national themes in this race, even though these are native Ohioans who are running, there's an awful lot of national money and national verbiage in the race that has nothing really to do with us. It has to do with national ideas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting if he can bring that back a little bit and at least cause them to talk about Ohio's economy and the things we talk about on this show.
You know, back in 2016, when there were, or 2015, 2016, when there were about, I don't know, 15,000 Republicans running for president or for the nomination, people thought that was a weakness. That would splinter the party too much. It certainly did splinter the party, and it was bizarre. I mean, watching them argue with each other about how big their hands were and stuff like that. But I'm wondering if, you know, we've learned a lesson that that's not necessarily a weakness, and that likewise with all of these Republicans, there's five, if with Matt Dolan, it makes it six going for this Republican nomination. Strength or weakness, Andrew?
I think it probably helps Democrats that they have basically a singular candidate, Representative Tim Ryan.
That's what I think they thought back when in Hillary Clinton days.
But he'll have the opportunity to just sit back and raise money. And, you know, whereas the Republican candidates are competing for a limited number of donors. So kind of like in that blocking and tackling campaigning sense of the word, it will probably help Democrats to the extent that matters. I mean, ultimately, you know, it's the inertia of Republican advantage here is what it is. In terms of the actual Republican candidates themselves, I'm sure they'll be fine. It'll be interesting to see kind of what the tenor of the race continues to be and who ends up winning. If it's a fractured field and somebody like Josh Mandel ends up winning the nomination, that might give Democrats a better chance if the Republican process, puts forward somebody who's divisive. But like I said, I mean, until Democrats actually win a statewide election in Ohio that has the word Democrat next to their name,
right.
I will continue to just think that Republicans will have a huge advantage no matter what.
Right. And I mean, remember, though, that now they only need 20%, 21% of the vote to win if there are five candidates and maybe six. So that person isn't necessarily going to represent the majority of Republicans' view, let alone the majority of Ohioans' view, which is what they have to win in November.
What do you think, Jackie? Next November, I know.
What they said.
What they said. There was something, is there something pending or was it enacted that on Supreme Court races now you have to identify the party?
Yeah, that's a new one. So just kind of what I was alluding to. And I do want to say Sherrod Brown is a Democrat who won statewide, but as all Democrats have to do is find somebody who's held elected office for 40 years and nominate them. So that'll be, but anyways. So the three out of the last four Supreme Court elections in Ohio, Democrats have won. And it's, I think, a combination of that first, well, three things. One, nobody knows who judges are, period. Mm-hmm. Two, in Ohio, you have to, if you want to be nominated for a state Supreme Court or a state appellate court race, or even local races, you have to win a partisan primary. But on the actual November ballot, it does not say what party you're from. And so you'll see the parties nominate people with Irish-sounding names because people like to elect Irish-sounding people to elect to judicial
offices.
Ohio's
weird about its names.
And it just becomes incredibly arbitrary. And so that's what will be new for 2022 is you'll actually see Republican and Democrat next to their names. And also they've moved the Supreme Court races will be higher up on the ballot so that you won't have voters failing to get to the four-page ballots.
And this is a Republican-led effort.
Yes.
So they think this is something that will benefit them.
It was interesting. There was a Democratic co-sponsor of a similar piece of legislation from the previous legislative session, and he took his name off the bill kind of at the last minute after the November election and Democrats won another Supreme Court seat. I think he kind of saw the writing on the wall, but you know, he did not say that. But I feel like it's almost just so obvious that it's just common sense.
Well, I think that bill would have done local races, like the Common Pleas Court and the lower court races.
But the one that passed doesn't?
The one that passes only state Supreme Court and appellate court elections.
Secretary of State Frank LaRose said last week that his office referred just 13 votes cast in last year's election as possible voter fraud, which means that zero, it's,
we did the math. There's a lot of zeros.
Yeah, there's a lot of zeros 1%. Before one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and he did hold a news conference to make this referral.
I was surprised.
Which he, in the past couple of years, I think he has, and in the past, he has done it as a news release.
Yeah.
And he's running, so he maybe wants to get out there. But he both sort of emphasized law and order on election fraud while also acknowledging in the Q&A that this is extremely rare. I think he said to Andrew's question, which was good, that, I'm out here because people are losing faith in elections and I want them to know this is all good. But the news conference was called to talk about, I think that the theme of it was something like, we want to talk about election safety and
stoking those fears,
right, exactly.
Not necessarily.
But it's a
them.
Teeny tiny. In fact, it's about half, if my math was right, of the previous cycle, which wasn't even a national election. There were something like 270 referrals 2 years ago, and only 117 this year.
So it's incredibly rare. And actually, it's pretty normal for there to be around 100 or 200. And often what the case is that this specific issue is if you are don't have legal citizenship status in America or in Ohio or in the U.S., you can't vote in an election. And what happens is that they'll give you a voter registration form at the BMV and you can get a driver's license if you're a permanent legal resident. So people just fill out the form. They maybe don't understand, what it is, if English isn't their first language.
They don't know the law. Yeah, right.
So just oftentimes the referrals end up being don't going anywhere.
They're
because
just mistakes.
There's no intention by the voter to defraud anybody.
Right.
The other thing that we've heard in the past on this issue is it's that people think that registering to vote will help them get residency here and help them become
again,
a
they don't understand what, right. Yeah. All right. Well, Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau Chief, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice
to have you on board. And Julie Carsmeis, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks for your time, as always.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.